For most of 2010, my executive producer and I, Wayne Winkler, were developing this show. It was just a mere gleam in our eyes at that point, and it took us the better part of a year to figure out what we were going to do and how we're going to produce the show and everything else. That very same year, the Supreme Court came out with one of the most controversial decisions it had given in decades, the Citizens United case, where it essentially struck down decades worth of campaign finance laws, finding both that corporations are people and that speech is money. Two very controversial assertions with significant consequences since. Ever since that time, we've been saying we've got to do a show on Citizens United. We've got to do a show on Citizens United. And here it is. It's your weekly constitutional. It's Citizens United. And this, appropriately enough, is our special fundraising episode. Stay tuned.
This is your weekly constitutional, underwritten by James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
Welcome to a special money episode of your weekly constitutional. Money in two senses. The first, of course, is I'm going to be asking you for money during this episode because public radio, like the rest of the world, goes round and round based on the availability of money. But money also in the theoretical sense. What exactly is money? Is money paper in your wallet? Or is money blips on your computer records? Or is money something else? Is it perhaps even something that's protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution? Is it perhaps speech? Well, the United States Supreme Court seems to think it is. Ever since the Citizens United case in 2010, at least, though as we'll see, it's got a longer provenance than that. And there are a couple people, actually there are quite a few people, who are extremely critical of that decision. Two of them today, Ron Fine and John Bonifaz of an organization called Free Speech for People, are going to speak with us today, and they're going to tell us chapter and verse just why they think Citizens United should be overturned.
My name is John Bonifaz. I'm the co-founder and president of Free Speech for People. We're a national campaign launched on the day of the Supreme Court Citizens United ruling more than 4 years ago to press for a constitutional amendment to overturn that ruling and the underlying doctrines that impact our democracy so detrimentally by that ruling and prior precedent. We also engage in the courts and legal advocacy to push back against Citizens United and related rulings and to restore democracy to the people.
Okay, and someone else is on the line too. Ron, who are you and what do you do?
Hi, I'm Ron Fine. I'm the legal director at Free Speech for People. And the legal advocacy program, as John mentioned, is primarily involved in pushing back in the courts against claims of corporate constitutional rights and defending campaign finance restrictions.
Well, and you guys founded your group and dedicated yourselves to overturning it on the very day Citizens United was handed down?
Yes, actually, the co-founder, Jeff Clements, and I began to discuss this campaign as the Supreme Court was hearing argument again in the Citizens United case. The Citizens United case, you know, went before the Supreme Court in the spring of 2009, and then the Supreme Court held it over for additional argument and really broadened the scope of the entire case to look at sweeping away a century of precedent barring corporate money in our elections. And in light of that, Jeff Clements, the co-founder and chair of our board, filed an amicus brief before the Supreme Court during the re-argument of Citizens United, arguing that corporations are not people with constitutional rights and that therefore the claims being made that somehow this century of precedent should be overturned should not be accepted. In the process of doing that amicus brief, he and I connected, and we began to map out a campaign that would address what would happen if the court goes over the cliff, as it eventually did in ruling in Citizens United, in a 5-4 decision, that in fact this century of precedent should be swept away and that corporations are people with political speech rights with the ability to spend unlimited general treasury dollars in our elections.
So you're ready to go, basically, when the decision came down not your way, which is impressive in itself because, you know, most people involved in cases at least want to believe that they have a chance of winning. and, you know, actually thinking through what they're going to do if they lose is something rather unpleasant that most people really don't want to spend any time on. So that's rather impressive. And Ron, were you also involved from the very beginning?
No, I just began in January of this year, and that was the launch of the legal advocacy program. And since then, we've been engaged in litigation around the country, everywhere from the U.S. Supreme Court to state trial court in Missouri and a federal district court in Hawaii. And these actions are best viewed as trying to, one, contain the damage from Citizens United and prevent it from spreading into new areas, and two, to push back and offer new ways of thinking about the issues of corporations, the Constitution, and money in politics, to help push forward the new way of thinking so that when the court is ready, it'll be have the thinking available to it to retract the error of its decision.
Okay. Well, let's start at the beginning then. Why don't you tell me what, I mean, everyone's heard of Citizens United, but why don't you go ahead and tell me exactly what was held in that case and exactly why you find it objectionable?
The Citizens United decision brought together two mistaken conceptions of the Constitution. Both of these mistakes had been around for several decades or more, but Citizens United combined them in ways that created a new set of problems. Citizens United was a challenge to a campaign spending law that had essentially existed for a century. Since Teddy Roosevelt's administration, the federal government had prohibited corporations from spending money in elections. And that law had been amended from time to time, but that core provision had been in there since 1907. And Citizens United was a challenge to the most recent version of the prohibition on corporations spending money in federal elections. And in reaching its decision, the Supreme Court combined two mistakes that had been in its cases for a couple of decades and then added a third. And by doing this combination of mistakes, it created a whole new set of problems.
Okay. What were those mistakes?
The first mistake was treating corporations as having the same constitutional rights as people.
But Mitt Romney told us that corporations are people, my friend.
Yeah, that's his view. That's not the view that the Founding Fathers had. The Founding Fathers viewed corporations as an important part of our economy, to be sure, but a necessary evil at best that needed to be controlled by democracy because of their immense power, which has only increased since then. And by giving them constitutional rights, what that really means, what people need to think about when they hear what does it mean for a corporation to have constitutional rights, what that means is that if the people pass a law and a corporation doesn't like it, the corporation can go to court and get a judge to strike down that law or maybe get a special exemption from that law based on a constitutional claim. And there's not much that the people can do to change that short of getting a new Supreme Court or amending the Constitution. So that's what it means when we say that corporations are given constitutional rights, is it means that we lose democratic control over corporations.
Well, let me play devil's advocate there. Let me take Mitt Romney's part here. I think what he was grasping at, and I'm not an apologist for him and I'm not a mind reader, but I always interpreted his statement to mean that corporations, although they certainly are legal fictions, and they certainly in some sense are, you know, not composed of people. Ultimately, they are owned by people. They are run by people. They are peopled by people. And so why should we not allow this organization of people to exercise the same sort of constitutional rights that individual people might exercise?
I think the key point to remember is that a corporation is a separate legal entity from the people that work there, and certainly the people that own the stock. That's actually the whole point of having a corporation, is to have a separate legal entity. So if a corporation runs up bad debts, the creditors can't go after the stockholders for anything more than the value of the stock that they own. They can't repossess a stockholder's house. And mm-hmm. by the same token, if a stockholder runs up a bad debt, the creditors can't go after the corporation. So that separateness is the whole reason for having a corporation. And it serves a useful role in our economic and legal system to give corporations this separateness. And in many cases, we've decided as a democracy to treat by law corporations as having some of the same legal rights as people. So, for example, corporations in every state can sue and be sued. Mm-hmm. And if there is a decision of a government agency that goes against them, most of the time the law will provide a pathway for them to challenge that decision of the agency. And no one questions this. No one questions whether corporations should be able, for example, to buy and sell property. That's not the
issue. Yeah, they kind of have to, right, to do their jobs.
Exactly, exactly. That's not the question. Those are rights that we have given to corporations through the state laws that create corporations. The issue is when a law is passed that regulates corporate behavior and the corporation claims a constitutional right to ignore that law, who exactly is it asserting that right on behalf of? And I can give you an example.
Please.
That comes from a case right after Citizens United. Vermont passed a law that restricted the ability of pharmaceutical businesses to sell patient prescription information that was basically indicating which doctors were prescribing which drugs more so that they could market more effectively to those doctors. And the people of Vermont, for better or worse, some people like this law, some people didn't, but the law was passed democratically, decided that this sort of information shouldn't be freely sold. And the companies came in and said that it violated their First Amendment right to freedom of speech. And the Supreme Court agreed, treating the corporation as having a right to freedom of speech that completely trumped the interests of the patients and the doctors in having some degree of privacy in their prescription records.
So does it boil down to the idea that corporations are already too powerful in society and giving them constitutional rights simply makes them more powerful?
It makes them able to go to the unelected branch, and certainly in the federal government, unelected branch, and get a bite at the apple with respect to laws that they lost in fighting in the political branches. So if they don't do well in the state legislature in resisting a law that they don't like, and usually they do quite well in the state legislatures because they have sufficient economic and political influence, but if the democratic process actually works and a corporation is at the wrong end of that stick and doesn't like a law, it can essentially get a judicial revocation that is based on a theory that doesn't fit. And that's the issue, is that the corporation's constitutional right claim is based on the assumption that the corporation, which is an artificial legal entity created by the state, has rights against the state that are separate and different from any rights of the stockholders. No one is questioning that when you talk about a corporation, the employees have rights, the managers have their constitutional rights, the stockholders have their constitutional rights. But when you look at some of the claims that corporations are making, that they shouldn't have to disclose whether they're using genetically engineered foods in their products.
Right, those labeling laws, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. They shouldn't have to disclose whether the products that they make contain blood gold that comes from the war-torn regions of Central Africa. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't have to disclose where the meat that they're selling comes from. And you ask, whose constitutional right is actually being violated? It's very hard to be able to find a person who you could point to and say, that's the person whose constitutional right to free speech is being violated by this law.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this is a special fundraising episode of the show during which we're appropriately enough talking about money. We're talking about money in politics. We're talking about Citizens United, and I'm speaking with John Bonifaz and Ron Fine from an organization called Free Speech for People. And as you might guess, these guys don't much like the Citizens United case. After the break, we will continue our discussion with John and Ron, so stick around. Before the break, we were talking about the concept of corporate personhood, that is, treating a corporation like a real human being for purposes of constitutional rights. It's not as clear-cut and simple as it sounds, and it turns out that the Supreme Court has, at various times, treated corporations as people or not, depending on the constitutional right in question. I've heard some people say on your side of the argument that if it doesn't breathe, then it shouldn't have a constitutional right. But again, I'm struggling here with to figure out exactly why that is. I mean, certainly corporations get a second bite at the apple, as you say, by challenging a law that they didn't like when it was passed in the judicial branch. But of course, that's what an individual does too. If I as an individual fight against a law and I lose, well, if I think it's unconstitutional, I go in and I file my claim against it. So again, I don't know exactly why it is that it's more offensive for a corporation to do that than it is for an individual to do that. I guess you said the founders really differentiated between corporations and individuals?
That's right. If you look at the writings of some of the founding fathers, they very explicitly noted that corporations were a necessary evil to be tolerated. Mm-hmm. And they certainly didn't think of them. Certainly the Constitution doesn't mention corporations. The founders certainly didn't think of corporations as being rights-bearing entities. I think the reason that it's more disturbing for corporations to be claiming constitutional rights is precisely because they're artificial creatures of the state in the first place. They're not endowed with unalienable rights by their creator. They're creatures of the state in the first place.
Right.
And the state gives them the ability to amass economic fortune, gives them special privileges that are not available to people, such as limited liability, perpetual life, and a whole host of other advantages that we've consciously given corporations those legal privileges, and that's fine, but the creation is outrunning the creator.
Sort of the Frankenstein monster theory.
You might say so.
Yeah, and moreover, if you think back on some of the reasons we have a First Amendment, just to take one example of an individual right, concerns about free political process, concerned certainly about individual autonomy, or just the visceral reaction we have as individuals when someone tries to tell us we can't say or read or think a particular thing. It's hard to imagine a corporation, this artificial creature, having any of those feelings or many of those interests, unless we equate them with the people who own them or the people who run them. And as you pointed out, they aren't the same thing. That's a very interesting and a fairly nuanced question. But that's really only the first of your three objections to the Citizen United case. So I interrupted you, but let's go on. What's number two?
Well, number two dates back to the early 1970s, and that's treating campaign spending as an issue of freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to the Buckley versus Valeo decision, where the Supreme Court, reviewing Congress's post-Watergate attempt to rein in campaign spending, said that the government, whether it be federal, state, or local, can't restrict spending in elections. They did allow some room to limit contributions directly to candidates, but basically removed the ability to restrict spending that's so-called independent expenditures.
Right. And the argument there is that when I, running my own campaign or maybe representing a campaign, when I go out and I spend money, I am somehow saying it's the equivalent of saying vote for me.
Well, the issue with money and speech is obviously money is used to facilitate speech. No one's questioning that. But the fact that you have a right to speech, and certainly an individual obviously has a right to free speech, doesn't necessarily mean that you should have the same unlimited right to spend as much money as you possibly can in that area. And I'll give a couple of examples. We know that governments can make rules about volume. There are Supreme Court cases involving, for example, the volume of a rock concert in a public park, or volume of sound trucks driving down the street blaring advertisements. And the Supreme Court has said there is no problem with setting reasonable limits on how loud speech can be. But in the political arena, where money is basically the analog to volume in those other cases, the Supreme Court has treated it in an entirely different way, saying that the money itself essentially is the speech. And it's simply not true that just because we have a right to do something, we necessarily have a right to spend money doing it. So, for example, we all have a right to vote, but we don't have a right to buy someone's vote. We have a right to speak to our congressmen. We don't have a right to bribe our congressmen. We have a right to have the sexual partner of our choice. We don't have a right to engage in prostitution. So there are many areas where courts have recognized that just because you have a right to do something doesn't necessarily mean that you have a right to spend money or as much money as you might like engaging in that right. And the court has recognized in other contexts, not in political spending, sensible, reasonable limits on volume or amount or use of money to do something that might facilitate a constitutional right, but the money itself is not a constitutional right.
So if I'm Bill Gates and I decide I want to be president, it's perfectly okay to say, vote for me, Bill Gates, to make me president. But it's not necessarily all right for me to take $10 billion and crank up the volume, as you say, and drown out my opponents with all that money.
That's right. And it tends to create several different problems. One, of course, is that it can literally drown out everyone else so that somebody who's running against Bill Gates simply can't be heard. In the days of the internet, we sometimes forget that some of the communication channels really are limited. There's only so much ad space you can buy on TV. And even when you talk about an infinite number of channels and websites, there's only so much attention space that people have. So someone who can just flood the airwaves with advertisements does have the potential to drown out other voices. The other point, though, is that by giving money to candidates, either directly in the form of a contribution or indirectly through the form of so-called independent expenditures, big spenders have an influence over legislators, even when we're not at election time, that ordinary people can't have.
Okay, let's differentiate, though. On the one hand, if I understood you, you were saying the Buckley decision essentially took away limits on candidates spending money. But it did allow some continuing limits on contributions to candidates, whether direct or indirect, as you've said. Now, the distinction there is that, and the argument there is that if I, as a campaign contributor, want to give $10 to Bill Gates, for example, then I'm saying implicitly, I think Bill Gates's candidacy is worth $10 of my money. But if I really feel strongly about Bill Gates, then I give him $100 or I give him $1,000. And so the more money I give, the more exclamation points and underlining I'm putting beneath my support for Bill Gates. Isn't that the argument on the contribution side?
That is the argument. And, you know, there are some settings in life where we allow the ones who have more money to simply outbid everyone else. If there's an auction for a piece of property, the one who has the most money is able to buy it, and tough luck to the ones without money. In our democratic politics, we don't like to think of it that way. We don't like to think of democracy as being a matter for auction, where the one who has $10 has less of an influence on his congressman or his senator or his state rep than the one who has $10,000.
We don't like to think of it that way, but I sense that that's what you feel is actually out there.
That is the problem. And Buckley introduced the possibility that contribution limits can be regulated, but by leaving spending out there, it left a hole. And unfortunately, Citizens United blew that hole wide open. Mm-hmm. Because now, contributions are actually only a small part of the picture now. Now the big spenders don't engage in contributions because those are still, for the time being, subject to limits. Now what the big spenders do is they give to so-called dark money groups that don't have to report their donors. And those dark money groups spend, they nominally avoid coordinating with the campaigns, but they do so with a wink and a nod that everyone knows exactly what's going on. And through the use of devices such as super PACs, they can spend vast amounts of money in elections without any regulation whatsoever, because it's technically not considered a contribution. It's considered an independent expenditure. And the candidates know exactly who's spending money on their behalf and who's spending money against them. So it has the same negative effect as a contribution, but it's not regulated at all.
Right. In fact, I think if you look at a number of these circumstances, the people who run these so-called independent groups have, up to the moment they founded them, had been working directly for the candidates.
That's right. So on
and
Monday,
then they just agreed on. Go ahead. Give your example.
I was going to say, on Monday, you're the campaign manager for someone. And on Tuesday, you tender your resignation at 9 in the morning. And by 10 a.m., you've set up an independent expenditure group. You know exactly the message that the candidate wants. You know exactly the way that he or she wants the opponents attacked. And so this was really best illustrated by Stephen Colbert, actually, on television from the Colbert Report on Comedy Central, where he transferred his super PAC to Jon Stewart of The Daily Show and told Jon, we can't coordinate our political activities. You'll just have to watch my TV show every day to find out what I'm doing.
Yeah, I remember that episode. That's where they actually had a green glow around their hands, didn't they, when they passed this power back and forth?
That's right, the mind meld.
But what was interesting to me was that they actually were signing documents that had been prepared by one of their lawyers, and that they actually did form a super PAC, and that this was all exactly, I mean, it was happening before everyone's eyes.
If I'm not mistaken, that lawyer was Trevor Potter, who was a former commissioner of the federal Elections Commission, and if I don't want to vouch for the documents because I didn't see them myself, but it is apparently entirely legal. And that shows that many a times the scandal is not what's illegal, the scandal is what's legal.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking about the notorious Citizens United case with two fellows who don't like it very much. Their names are John Bonifaz and Ron Fine, and they're from an organization called Free Speech for People. Stick around. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish my discussion with John Bonifaz and Ron Fine of Free Speech for People. I'll play devil's advocate on this one. So what you're telling me is that you don't like the idea of me, Stuart Harris, you know, forming the Stuart Harris PAC and then soliciting donations from all my buds or from whomever wants to give me money, and then just going out and deciding that I want to attack, you know, Hillary Clinton, or I want to attack Marco Rubio, and I just want to happen to air my attacks in the 6 weeks leading up to the next presidential election. It gets a little bit concerning. Let's say in Citizens United, I think the issue was a DVD. It was a movie. I mean, it's something that we normally consider core political speech. And yet we propose, or you propose then, to put limits on me producing a DVD that attacks one of those two candidates on issues of great public concern and preventing me from distributing my video or maybe a campaign book, you know, printed matter, which is core First Amendment speech. Does that concern you?
Well, one of the interesting issues about Citizens United is that they didn't even have to reach the issues that you discuss. John mentioned that they re-argued it, because when the challenge first came from Citizens United, they were basically just claiming that the documentary movie that they had made wasn't actually subject to the law. And the Supreme Court certainly could have resolved it that way, but reached out to address an issue that no one was raising,
right,
which is the entire constitutionality of the issue. Look, the right policy for campaign finance is actually a very tricky problem. It's a devilishly complex policy problem, and there are many individual pros and cons, and there has to be a complex balancing of various interests in coming to the right scheme. And it may be very difficult to come up with something that's perfect and optimal in every circumstance. But what I can say is that having the Supreme Court come in and strike out large parts of it totally prevents the democratic process from even trying to go down the route of reining in campaign spending.
So you'd simply rather leave the issue to Congress here and have the court step back and say, you know, this is something that so much a core part of the democratic process that we're going to let Congress opine on it and we're going to step back from it?
You know, the way I would think of it is that we have, it's not just Congress. We have 50 state campaign finance regimes, plus many more at local levels. In many cases, these are passed by direct voter initiative. So there's not even the question of whether there's any self-interest on the part of those who are passing it. Mm-hmm. And these are the democratic experiments that our system was designed to foster. The laboratories of democracy in different states. It could be that one state might decide to pursue a system of complete public financing. Another state might want to choose a system like that proposed by some of the senators, which is a system of public vouchers for campaign spending, where each citizen is given a voucher for a fixed amount of money and can then give that to the candidate of their choice. Another state might want to regulate campaign finance very lightly, if at all. And these are the types of debates that as voters and elected officials should engage in and have a democratic process to discuss, because the democracy should ultimately be under the control of the voters. By having the Supreme Court inject itself and selectively strike out certain parts and make certain options unavailable forever, when these options are not about banning particular speech or particular speakers, but simply the volume at which these the speech can be spoken and the amount of sunlight that needs to be brought to it, by preventing the people from reaching such democratically enacted options, the Supreme Court essentially makes us like children at the hands of whoever is able to spend the most.
Okay, have we gotten to your third objection?
The third objection is something that's specific to the campaign finance context, and this is something that goes a step beyond Buckley versus Valeo, because what I've said so far about the analysis of independent expenditures being an issue of freedom of speech does trace back to Buckley. But Citizens United introduced a further amplification of that, which is Justice Kennedy, who wrote the opinion, said that as a matter of law, there you could never come up with any set of facts that could prove otherwise. The only way in which restrictions on campaign spending can be justified is if they cause corruption. And as a matter of law, independent spending can never corrupt.
And wow.
People didn't notice that immediately after the Citizens United, but someone did, and that someone was an organization called Speech Now, which went to the Federal Election Commission and then ultimately the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and got a ruling that followed on the logic of Citizens United, and that's what opened the door for super PACs. And what the Speech Now case said, the D.C. Circuit said, well, if independent spending can't corrupt.
And the theory there, just let me interrupt you, is that if you don't give money to a candidate, then you can't be bribing him.
That's exactly right. That's Justice Kennedy's theory.
Okay.
So building on that, the D.C. Circuit said, if independent spending can't corrupt, then giving to a middleman organization that is going to engage only in independent spending can't corrupt either. And so what that meant is that PACs, which used to collect contributions from various people and then bundle them together and give them to a candidate, essentially those types of PACs don't have very much of an influence anymore, because at this point now people mostly go with what are called super PACs, and the super PACs accept contributions with no limit, with no disclosure requirements, and
right in the minute and the minute they bundle them and give them to a candidate, then they have to disclose their donors.
Exactly.
So if I am Mr. Rich Guy who wants to influence an election but does not want that to be made public, for example, I think I want to help a Democrat, but I think that if it's publicly known that I'm helping a Democrat, that could hurt my Republican friends or my Republican clients might no longer hire me. So I want to keep secret my political leanings, and so I donate to a super PAC, and I can donate as much as I want, which will then be spent, but nobody has to know that I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican.
Well, and the way you do it is you route it through a nonprofit group, a so-called 501c4 group, and that can have a name like Americans for America. And then Americans for America makes the donation to the super PAC, and you know, and the super PAC will have a name like Citizens for Freedom.
I keep waiting for one, Citizens for Truth, Justice, and the American Way.
Exactly.
That's the one I want to join.
And so whatever disclosures there are, aren't going to trace back to the original wealthy mega donor. And then that organization can spend as much as it wants in political elections without any limitation. And the other aspect that people don't realize is some people say, well, you know, maybe you could just require them to disclose how much they're spending, and then we would know. And the problem is that just as important is the amount that they are spending is the amount that they threaten to spend. So a super PAC can let it be known to a candidate or an incumbent that if the incumbent doesn't vote the way that the super PAC wants, then a week before Election Day, that super PAC will let forth a blizzard of hostile negative advertising, accusing the candidate of all sorts of depravities, and the candidate won't be able to respond because he'll have maxed out all of his direct contributors. So simply by threatening to spend money, the super PACs can induce compliance among the candidates and incumbents. And that's one of the features that can never be corrected by disclosure, because you can't disclose money that hasn't been spent.
And so you disagree with Justice Kennedy, and you think that, in fact, independent expenditures can be corrupting after all.
I would say that virtually any politician who would speak to you on an honest day, and we've got many of them after they leave office, speaking quite honestly about this, would tell you that an independent expenditure, which, as we've discussed before, these days isn't really independent, can corrupt just as much as a direct contribution.
So, Ron, John, what's your solution to all of this?
Well, I think that the focus really has to be, Stuart, on both pushing back in the courts to overturn these rulings, but also to press for a constitutional amendment to overturn these rulings. And I do want to come back to your question, you know, as to whether or not we're asking the court to simply step back. I think that the correct framework for what we're dealing with here in this current crisis for our democracy is to look at prior instances where we as a people have used the constitutional amendment process to overturn egregious Supreme Court rulings where the court was simply wrong. So the 13th Amendment to the Constitution that bans slavery overturns a Supreme Court ruling that sanctions slavery.
Dred
the
Scott.
19th Amendment guaranteeing women the right to vote overturns a Supreme Court ruling saying that women did not have the right to vote under the 14th Amendment. Mm-hmm. The 24th Amendment that bans poll taxes in federal elections overturned two prior Supreme Court rulings that said that poll taxes were constitutional and were necessary fees for charging to voters in order to determine their seriousness as voters. So here are three examples, and there are really seven overall of the 27 amendments that can be interpreted as overturning prior Supreme Court rulings. But here are three in which we as a people went through the process using Article 5 powers under the Constitution to amend the Constitution to overturn the Supreme Court. And this is not about really, you know, the court stepping back. This is about saying the court got it wrong. This is such a direct threat to the republic, to the promise of American self-government, that we need to amend the Constitution again. And that's really the fight now that we face as a country. We need a 28th Amendment that overturns the Citizens United and Buckley rulings, that restores democracy to the people, that ensures that corporations are not people with constitutional rights, that we the people govern, not we the corporations, and that allows all of us, through our elected representatives, to determine what reasonable limits can be passed to rein in campaign spending and to ensure that all our voices are heard in the political process.
Do you have proposed language that you're pushing?
We do. In fact, we've worked closely with Senator Udall's office, Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico, and with the Senate Judiciary Committee. And the Senate Subcommittee of the Judiciary, the Subcommittee on the Constitution, just passed language that we, along with organizational allies in the movement, have urged be used to go forward. And essentially, there are three main provisions. One is to make clear that Congress and the states shall have the power to enact reasonable limits on campaign spending to advance the basic principles of American self-government, as well as political equality for all, and to protect the integrity of our elections. Second provision deals specifically with Citizens United, making clear that Congress, in enacting this amendment, in implementing this amendment, can distinguish between natural persons and artificial creatures of the state, namely corporations, including forbidding corporate money altogether in our elections, as was the case prior to Citizens United. And then third, a provision that makes clear that nothing in this amendment should be deemed to abridge the freedom of the press, which is an entirely different matter than freedom of speech under the First Amendment.
Well, where can people see a copy of this proposed language? I'm guessing you have a website?
We have a website at freespeechforpeople.org. The newest language that's just been passed by the subcommittee is not yet online. It will soon be online on our site. But at freespeechforpeople.org, people can visit and see both the language for the amendment dealing with money in our elections, as well as the language of a separate amendment, which we call the People's Rights Amendment, which would overturn this fabricated doctrine of corporate constitutional rights.
Which goes well beyond campaign finance. So interesting stuff. Well, gentlemen, John, Ron, I really appreciate your time and explaining your position to me so fully. And thank you for being on your Weekly Constitutional.
Thank you, Stuart.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to John Bonifaz and Ron Fine of Free Speech for People and all of their criticisms of the Citizen United case. What a fantastic interview. And it was all done via Skype. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris. And guess what? All of this costs money. So get on the phone, get on the internet, and give some to your public radio station.